Welcome to the Real Talk of Dental, where we pull back the bib and talk about what's really going on beneath the surface. Not just the charts, not just the systems. We're talking about the culture, the chaos, and the confessions. I'm Brandy Marzolino, and with 20 years deep in this industry, I am fresh out of patience for performative leadership. This is your space to laugh, cry, question everything, and maybe shout into a pillow between patients. We've got anonymous confessions, we've got call-ins, we've got ops room drama, and we've got the truth, served hot and a little too real. Think of this as your backstage pass to the break room no one dares to mic. Until now. Imagine changing dentists while you're living in Boston and you find out that your new dentist gives you a whole different diagnosis than your last dentist. And that sparks an idea in your head that, something needs to change. Well, that was the inspiration behind Wardaw Inham, the CEO and founder of Overjet AI, one of the leading AI tech companies in dentistry today. And they are at the forefront of the dental insurance integration and the first FDA-approved AI tech company in dentistry. Wardaw is an exceptional human being, and she's a total vibe. And even though she's quite the problem solver and the get shit done type, she has a very compassionate and empathetic heart, driven by an incredible purpose, and also wants other people to follow their purpose and their dreams as well. Her best suggestion is to figure out who you are and then follow that and be true to yourself, which I say it all the time, is a huge part of the work that I do inside the Empowered Leadership Experience for Women in Dental, where the entire curriculum is about helping women get to their core root of figuring out who they are and what is it they want to do and how they want to express it. And that's something that Wardaw is a big advocate for as well, because we both seem to agree that when you are aligned with yourself and with your purpose, life is a whole lot more fun and you enter into what I consider the flow state. She is really taken aback by my journey in the woods, and we have a really great conversation, not only about AI, but also about her personally, which is something that I'm really committed to sharing on this podcast. Please welcome Wardaw Inham. Wardaw, CEO of Overjet, which is just incredible. Everybody knows who you are. Everyone knows who your company is in dentistry. You've been on the forefront of AI over the last several years. And you're also the mom of a 3.5-year-old little boy. So tell me, what has it been like for you being a mom while also being a revolutionary in the dental industry? How the heck are you balancing this stuff, if at all?
The mom piece, I didn't realize how hard the job was. Everybody does it. So it was one of those things, like, you know, I didn't realize what all it entails, but it is very rewarding as well. So there is that side to it. But it has been busy. I work and then I spend time with my kid. Those are my two things that I do. So balancing it that way.
Yeah. Are you getting much sleep these days, or what is your sleep like?
Yeah, I do get sleep. I do prioritize sleep. It's one of those things. I can't function if I don't have sleep. You know, I then deprioritize other things in life.
Yeah, it's incredible. So, I mean, to me, you're a total trailblazer, and I just absolutely love like what you represent, especially being the head of a tech company and seemingly having like really cool team members and a cool culture and where your priorities are and what you're really passionate about. When did you decide that you wanted to bring AI into the world of dental? What inspired that for you?
That was in 2018. So it's been a while here. And it was basically due to a personal experience I had of changing my dentist, getting a new treatment plan, and realizing that they had given me different diagnoses and trying to understand what was happening there. And the more I learned, the more I got obsessed with dentistry, and the more I wanted to learn. So one thing led to another, and I quit my job, started shadowing dentists. I started building out Overjet.
God, that's so cool. So a lot of women that I work with, and especially, you know, I have my Empowered Leadership Experience for Women in Dentistry, and sometimes women are just so afraid to take that leap. Like, they realize what they want to do, or they have this kind of calling inside of them. And taking that next step is really scary for a lot of people, not just women. But what was the big thing for you that gave you the desire to, or just the courage to take that next step? And what would you say to somebody who was kind of struggling with making that leap? Because what you shared in that very brief segment took a lot of courage and a lot of guts and sounded like there was a ton of risk involved there. So how did you work yourself through that and give yourself the confidence to move forward and like that?
The other way, I was like trying to convince myself that I shouldn't leave and I should stay a little longer. But I think it's one of those things, if you really want to do something, it's like hard to convince yourself otherwise, or at least for me. And why it was the case was like, okay, like let's like figure this out a little more, because when I quit, it wasn't like I had the idea or anything. I knew the problem, and that's when I, you know, sometimes you want to build out more and have it more established, have some funding sources, etc. I didn't do that, and it was because I would wake up and this is what I would think about, and I would realize, like, at that time I had this realization that AI is going to be such an important change happening across, especially in healthcare, and there was an opportunity to really make a difference, and that's what was in my mind. And the question was, should I wait a little longer? And then I, you know, every day became harder to then focus on something else rather than this.
I love that. It was like something you just couldn't ignore anymore, just like a true calling.
Yeah, exactly. So I think for me, whatever I do it with all my focus, and it's hard for me to like half-ass anything. So, you know, and my job as well, like I was doing it, but when I wasn't like fully engrossed in that, like I knew. So, and that's very hard for me to be in a state where I'm not giving my all, my best every day.
Who are your mentors? Like, who have had the biggest impact on you as far as guiding you and inspiring you on your entrepreneurial journey or just in life?
Like, I take small inspirations from everyone. It isn't something that it's like one person that I like truly admire or anything, but they're many entrepreneurs that I, you know, learn from. And it might be just, might not even know them. I might be watching their videos or like learning how they're operating. It might be from my team members that I work with. Like, there might be things that they're really good at, that one thing, and I'm trying to learn from them around that thing as well. It might be even in this conversation, and like, you know, it's interesting how you frame some of these questions. And I was like, oh, that's a good way to frame. So like, I'm trying to learn from people around me and things that are happening. And I think just constantly growing and learning something that I really like.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm obsessed with learning. I think it's number two on my like Clifton Strengths or something like that. But the downside of that is I sometimes feel like I never know enough. Like, I'm insatiable sometimes. I just want to know more and more and more. And there's never an end, right, in how much we can learn. And sometimes it'll have like the, you know, opposite effect where I then realize like, oh my gosh, there's still so much to learn that I actually feel less confident in what I'm doing because I'm like, I don't know everything. So that's something that I personally struggle with a little bit with that. And my gosh, like, I can't imagine in the world of AI. I mean, it's like every day there's something new that's happening. So for you and being who you are and, you know, from your personality type and things like that, how do you balance, like, and again, I don't like using the word balance because I think there's no such thing, but how do you recalibrate, I guess, when you get really like, oh, there's so much more I need to know here and there's so much more we need to do? How do you space it out, like, from the development perspective?
So there's a few things there. One is just like learning. I'm like intrigued by something and I want to learn. The other is like, you know, operating with not complete knowledge, right? And that's always the case. And that's, I think Jeff Bezos has had a very good saying around that, or principles that, you know, people like to quote, but it is basically making decisions when you have like 70% of the knowledge, not 100%, because if you had 100%, anybody could make the decision. And if you try to get that much, it'll take too long. So, you know, you have to make decisions fast as well, especially so that you can keep on moving. How do you gather enough information to make the decisions needed? And that's kind of work I usually have to do if I'm going and trying to solve a problem. I have very little time basically to solve that problem as well. So I need to get as much information as I can as quickly as possible. And then with not having all that information, being able to, you know, trust your gut to make the decision. And those might be hard decisions. It might be decisions that might have long-term consequences, but you are making them and somebody has to, because like not making the decisions is worse, especially in a fast-growing company, than making a decision, then adjusting it as needed if you learn otherwise.
Yeah, and probably being, you know, in your position, you don't have the luxury to sit and ponder over things for a long period of time. You have to pretty much act and make those decisions. I get that. You know, everyone always talks about when they're even making a career, you know, when they're creating a career for themselves. So something I hear a lot too from dentists that I talk to, it's like they're in dental school and they have this fantasy about what it's like to be a dentist and the lifestyle and all the things. And then they become a dentist and they realize reality did not match the fantasy at all. And, you know, then they're working through that. And I can imagine, you know, as a someone who's looking to create this AI company and you had all these ideas, you know, coming from your experience at the dentist, you probably had a vision of what you wanted and what you were looking to create. And then as Overjet started building, you probably had more futuristic visions of what the company would look like. You know, can you share a little bit about what your fantasy was of the business compared to the reality? What are you recognizing now, like that you just had no idea was what your experience was going to be like running Overjet compared to what it actually is today?
Yeah, so interestingly for me, it kind of like started as like trying to solve that problem. It didn't start as like, oh, I need to build this company and it's going to be big. It was just like, okay, this is a real problem. It needs to, you know, it needs to be solved. It needs to exist. It was sort of started as a project. So it wasn't, you know, and then of course, like we formulated a company and like, you know, came up with a name and all those things like happened as I was progressing, you know. So at times it might be a strength, at times it might be a weakness. Like I don't have like that much of like, things have to be exactly a certain way, you know, or I'm like trying to imagine that. I do think about the future, but it is in, you know, things that need to exist. That's how like I usually think. It isn't, you know, all you, and which is like, of course, I need to work on that more of like thinking exactly how things will be laid out or the company would be. Things are also evolving so much, Brandy. Like, you know, if you think about, could you have imagined where LLMs would be in the last few years? Like you couldn't have, right? And now the work, how you do work has completely changed. And I would say how you build companies has completely changed. So I don't think I can like think that far ahead as well in terms of with all the change that happens and new opportunities come in and all that stuff. And I kind of really don't need to. We do have a North Star for Overjet, but it isn't like we have to build it this way or the company will look this way or the other. It does evolve. Like I actually just before getting on with you, I actually sent an email of all the org changes that are happening in Overjet. And, you know, did we know even 6 months ago that those will be the org changes we will do? Probably not, right? But with where we are, what we learned, reorg, you know, and move people around in areas and merge departments and separated departments. And yeah, so I would say it's less about how we do it, but more about like, where are we trying to get to?
Yeah, so it sounds like you have a really great ability of, you know, staying in the relatively present moment, like internally, like you have an idea of the direction that you're going, but you don't future trip too much, which sounds like it's pretty wise because you're totally right. Things happen that we never can predict. So, I mean, that's a practice. I mean, that's something that I actually have to work on personally is not future tripping too much because I like to plan and I like to have strategy and I want to make sure that I'm like, got all my ducks in a row. And then I learn all the time that, you know, you can plan for many things, but they more often than not do not happen, right? But I'm kind of like, I'm a slow learner when it comes to that. But it sounds like you really have it instilled in you as just your natural state of being. Like it sounds like you're pretty grounded and rooted. And
well, I would say that it'd be good to have that middle stage as well. So I think I have the present stage and I have like the future stage. And then like, there is like this like middle stage as well. If I was better at it, maybe there would be like things that I could like do with that skill as well. But it's not something that, you know, for example, you know, we were talking about the conference we're both going to. I don't know where, you know, what time that is. I don't know. I'll get to it when I'll get to it. While others, you know, there's more planning. And even now, like if I get a meeting, I might change the times. I'll be like, okay, I can go, you know. So I like, it's not, the plans are less rigid.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that's a great way to be, honestly.
It's different.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's an upside and downside to both ways, yeah, for sure. But I personally am always consistently working on being less rigid. I always am very like routine and very much by my calendar and stuff like that. But yeah, it's something that I'm personally working on too. So we'll pivot here just a little bit. I'm sure you get these questions a lot. But, you know, one of the big things I hear in the world of AI, especially in dentistry and just in general, like from a societal perspective with AI, is that AI is somehow big brother and almost a surveillance tool or something like that. And even though I might, you know, I use all the major AI platforms myself, and internally there's a part of me that's like, whatever, they're probably cloning me somewhere. The world can use more brandies, like who knows, you know. But in the space of dentistry, if you're a clinician, there's probably some innate fear that somewhere you could get caught or in trouble or something like that. How do you answer that question for a lot of people that have this fear of AI being a surveillance tool in their practice?
AI is a big word as well, right? So it like encapsulates everything. It's like saying, okay, is software surveillance tool or soft, you know, like it's like, I would say like software and AI can like be considered like very equal if like when you talk about it. Mm-hmm. So there would be AI tools which are like surveillance, and there's going to be like, I think there's going to be mass surveillance and all that stuff. And it's unfortunately is going to happen because within the technology will exist, things will happen as well. And not just in dentistry, but just like, you know, as citizens, you probably saw Anthropic versus the government that happened recently. You know, those are real things that are being considered because the technology can do it now. Now it's about intentions and what's going to happen. And I think that's the same way we should think about, can the technology do it? Absolutely it can. But should people do it? And what should people use it for? And I think that's, you know, that's why it's important, like, who's building the technology and like and what you know, building it with dentists. Like, that's been a very important piece for us at Overjet, which has been like really having dentists be part of all these decisions, because sometimes it's easier to do things when you think about others when you want to do it for yourselves and stuff like that. So like, we still try to always have that mindset, but how do we actually want to build the system that works as well, and which is not just optimizing for revenue, but it's optimizing for clinical care and all these other things that actually matter as well, and balancing those. So with that, I would say, could somebody use it for surveillance? People could, but is it being used for that? I don't think so. Like, it is a lot of data as well, and it's hard for people to like wrap their hands around that much data. We are still in very early days on how AI is getting adopted and how it's getting used across the board, but that's the opportunity for us to like be part of the building of this technology so that we build it in the right ways. And like, and that's what I would tell the dentist as well. Like, rather than like closing your eyes or closing your ears and saying, okay, you know, like this could be bad, or like this is developing and this is developing really fast and more things are going to get developed. So it's like either being part of that change because it's going to impact their profession, and either they can be part of it or not, that they're going to be impacted by it.
Yeah, the Anthropic stuff was fascinating to me and really opened my eyes. And I mean, I've always known that, you know, at that kind of level, AI is beyond anything that I could comprehend. But then hearing, you know, the founder talking about the use of it and how long they've been involved in the government, I was like, wow, this is way bigger than of course I knew that, but then when you hear it, it's like a totally different experience. Hey, I just want to pop in on today's episode and talk to you about this new GPT I wrote called Boundary Boss GPT. And it's for those moments where you've said yes to something and immediately felt that pit in your stomach, or maybe you've now written 5 drafts of an email because you're trying not to sound mean, even though you're exhausted and you swear you've said this thing so many times to the same person, or you're kind of sick and tired of staying late, taking it on, smoothing things over, and wonder why you're the one that's always burning out. A lot of the conversations that I have on this podcast, we often hear about people hitting these walls of burnout and oftentimes not even knowing what to say. So that's why I built Boundary Boss GPT. It's kind of like having me in your pocket when you're about to respond to a text, email, or team issue, and you just don't know what to say because your people-pleasing brain is completely hijacking you. This is going to help you have clarity, confidence, and self-respect without the guilt, over-explaining, or the drama. Go ahead and grab it in the show notes below. It's totally free, and you're going to love it. Okay, now back to this awesome conversation. One of the things that really stood out to me was, you know, Anthropic's commitment to like ethics and how they really want to still protect humans and things like that. So does Overjet have like ethical oversight, or is that something that's built into the company, or is that something that's still evolving there?
The good thing is because we get regulated by the FDA, right? So there's actually like rules that get applied. And I think they've provided really good guidelines around this. You know, and I think that was like what Dario was saying as well. Like, the Congress doesn't have legalities around mass surveillance because that technology didn't exist. The good thing is for medical devices, FDA got ahead of, like when we started, they didn't have it, but then they built out their, these got published as well. So what we have to prove is that the technology is as good as the clinicians, and it actually improves the clinician when they use it. So imagine, like, so there's two bars there. So imagine if it was like as good, but when clinicians used it, they got worse with it. That won't get cleared. So we have like clearances that we have to go through. So there is a regulatory framework around this technology as well, which is like helpful. There's also like consumer protection stuff that's placed as well. For example, if you look at the calls to patients and, you know, like robocalls, if you think about it, mm-hmm. right, or AI calls, there's consumer protection laws that come into play there as well. So it is a regulated industry that we work in with, you know, some other regulations that help as well. So there are good frameworks for it. Internally, the way we build at Overjet, and that's what I've had from like day one, is I say, you know, to the ML scientists, like, if you want this to be used on yourself, you know, and we are, where the good thing is we go to the dentists that use Overjet. That's something that we do on purpose, because if you wanted it to be, you, like, this will be used on you, and you should only release it when you think it's going to be good for you, not when it's bad. So sometimes, you know, there might be a time pressure and you want to release something, but if it's not good enough, do not release it, right? So we might hold on something, or it might be like there's pressure coming for something or the other. We do look at, for us, when we have to reconcile, we do look at the patient. So even if like there's pressure coming from like the teams on something or anything like that, in the end we say, okay, what's in the best interest for the patient, and let's do that, because in the end everything will align towards that.
Yeah. And I guess I just kind of want to circle back a little bit to your inspiration for starting this company, if you're willing to share a little bit. So you went to a few dentists, like you had something going on, right?
You didn't have anything going on. I just changed my neighborhoods. I was in Cambridge. I like went to Boston, and, you know, and this is like 10 minutes apart or something. And so I, you know, you usually go to a dentist close by. So like, I was like, okay, in this neighborhood, I changed my dentist, and that's how, and the new dentist, they did an exam. Every time you change the dentist, they do an exam. They don't get the previous data. They did an exam. So it was like 6 months apart probably. And they identified more things than the previous dentist had identified.
And you were thinking, how the heck did this happen? And they weren't using, I mean, it was just like two different dentists giving two different sets of diagnosis, essentially, yeah. Right? Not using any sort of special technology. And you were wondering why the previous dentist didn't see it, or the new dentist is finding out and wanting to use AI as a way to like fact check, essentially, or to like see the proof. Was that like the light bulb moment for you?
It was trying to reduce the variation of diagnosis and care. How do we reduce its variation? Yeah. Like, you should get the best care wherever you go. Like, that was like the original idea, right? Whether you're in the middle of Africa or you're in a expensive neighborhood in the US, like, you should be able to get the right, at least the diagnosis. We're like, we have the technology to do so. And then, of course, you know, the care can follow with it. But that was the original idea.
I love that, because that's something that gets talked about too with, you know, so much tech getting brought into it. Sometimes we forget the end point of all of this is the patient in your chair, right? And making sure that they get the best possible care. And I think that sometimes gets lost a little bit, where the big business of dentistry, and there's so many touch points along the way and so many aspects to like maximize, you know, the business that you have. But at the end of the day, if there isn't a patient in your chair, there's no business. You know, and then making sure that they get the best experience possible. And I love that you really speak to that. And that was also the, you know, birth of your business idea, is that it came from that place, which I think is really important to note, because that just really speaks to who you are and, you know, what's important to you. And not everybody comes from that place. So that's really cool. Something that I've hear a lot about too, you know, with CEOs, and I went to a CEO summit last year, and there were several on the stage, and something that they talked about consistently, no matter what companies they ran, was this experience of loneliness, you know, at the quote unquote top. And one of the reasons they said they often feel lonely is because when they were, you know, maybe even at the president level or regional level or something like that, people would invite them to things. And, you know, they were happy when they would come around, and they were like part of the team and part of the crew. And then all of a sudden, and then people would banter with you and also say they didn't like your idea. You know, they would challenge you a little bit. And they said the further they climbed, and when they finally got to the top, they were noticing people weren't inviting them out to lunch anymore. They weren't inviting them to things because they just didn't, who wants the boss around, you know? And then they were surrounded by a bunch of what they call yes men and yes women, where no one was going to argue with them or say their ideas sucked, you know? What has been your experience? Have you had moments of loneliness or feeling like everyone around me is just agreeing with me? I wish somebody would challenge me. And if you have, if that's not your experience, how did you create that for yourself?
I would say for me, where it gets like, you know, off is like when things are, you know, if say I had a manager and things weren't like, you know, I could at least complain to the manager, right?
Yeah.
Now you don't have anybody to complain to, right?
Yeah, you're the problem, right?
or you can't talk about a peer, right? So like you can't do that. And if, again, if you point it out, even like, I think that was like, for me, the hardest thing to get used to was that I'm a very direct person. Like I see what I see, you know, I'm like, okay, like if I'm saying, okay, this is good, this isn't good, like the, you know, I was giving my opinions like I would give normally. So say, you know, you had a deck and I'll be like, oh yeah, no, I you know, this side doesn't work, that works. And like for me it was like, okay, normal. And I think that's when I, you know, some people got like very like they take it very personally, and it's like, okay, like this is, I'm just saying this, like I'm not saying you're not good, like, you know, this not good, or this code is not good, or the output is bad. Oh, you guys made a mistake. And now I say that less of that in public. Like I would just tell them directly or say it a little differently. But I think that was the hardest to get used to, where, because before that, if you think about it, like I was an academic, right? So I was doing a PhD, which is all about truth seeking, right? You're getting things wrong, and then you get something right, and then you graduate, right? But it's almost like you kind of trained to like distinguish between things that are not good and good, and like you try to do that, and everybody around you is doing it, and you really value them for doing it, right? So say if you have an idea and it isn't good, if somebody tells you, hey, your idea is weak here, or this isn't good, like that's really good for you, because that means you are closer to graduating. Like, and somebody, like, and usually people can't, because they're not, you know, like they're not as expert in that area that you're trying to do your PhD in as well. So I think that was like the big change for me, like coming from an environment where everybody around me was like truth seeking in a way. And it was like, and we would just like, you know, somebody would like present and be like, oh, you got this wrong, like your output is wrong. And they would be like, this was a paper they would present on. Even sometimes it was like their PhD thesis, and like that was a good thing. Like you found the truth. Mm-hmm. And I think that was like one where that was the biggest like change for me, and like how to get used to it, but also how to create a culture of that, right? Because it naturally, as human beings, we're like more social creatures, right? Like we want to belong, we want to like not be causing more friction than needed, etc. And I feel like having that culture of like, okay, no, like for us, what matters is things are correct, we need to push ourselves, all that stuff is hard to do, and still working on it. But I think that was probably the hardest one for me. And especially coming from me, say if, you know, in the end, like somebody presented, it's like, oh, you actually made a mistake in the beginning. So all that was like off. So like, you can imagine, like, you know, people would be like very sad at the end of the presentation.
Very sad. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you're reminding me of, I got my master's in science, and you're reminding me of my thesis defense. So I, you know, had to get up in front of an auditorium of people. And then I had all these like grumpy old professors, you know, challenging me in the front few rows. And it was like terrifying. But at the same time, I had to know my shit, and I was prepared for it. And it builds those muscles, right? Because same way, like as a trained scientist, like I'm designed to think very critically, and I don't take it personally. Right? It's just like, oh yeah, no, like that's not right. And we're trying to get to the answer here. I think it's cool that you brought people on your team that, you know, are more sensitive to that, because you probably need that as well to balance it all out. But yeah, setting the tone, right? Like, hey, I believe in all of you. I want you all here. This is how I communicate. And this is like the context of which I'm approaching these conversations. And it's not personal. It's just, that's how my mind works. And I know sometimes just putting that out there, I mean, gosh, I even do that with my husband, right? Like with him and I living together, I can get very like, I turn into like house director. Like, okay, I need you to do this. I need you to do that. We got to do this. We got to do that. Like the mind's just going a million miles an hour. And when we were first living together, he was just like, oh, stop telling me what to do, you know? And he thought I was like his mother or something. And I'm like, no, no, no. And then we had to have this like reset. And I was like, hey, listen, when I'm talking like that, this is where I'm at. This is how my mind's working. And I'm not looking at it like I'm your boss or something. Like I'm just multitasking. My mind's firing, you know, a million miles an hour. And then we had this reset. And then he was like, okay, I can live with that. And so now when I bark my orders, he's very obedient. But I'm just joking. He'd kill me if you heard me say that. But he just does it. You know, it's not like a thing. So I think that's helpful and vice versa. So if he needs me to do something, like I'm on it, right? But we had to have that reset and just say, hey, this is where I'm coming from. And a lot of people skip over that. They don't set the context first and then feelings get hurt, like you're saying. So yeah, I mean, I guess who now in your life probably challenges you the most? Do you have people around you that really challenge you to just think outside the box or even just help you expand all different parts of yourself? Do you have those kind of folks in your life?
The good thing is I have people that I brainstorm with in the company, and it's like we're thinking together, we're like figuring out how do you 10x, what does that look like, what should the strategy be, etc. But I think it probably I'm lucky in that sense, but like they know when I'm like, okay, now this is what's going to happen. Like, but when we're in a brainstorming mode, that's very different, you know. But at times you need everybody to then be like, okay, even if there's disagreement, etc., this is what's going to happen, because you need everybody aligned and moving in the same direction. You don't want things not moving forward.
Yeah, that's awesome. Did you like living in Boston? Did you have a good time when you were there?
I did like living in Boston. So when I moved to the US, I moved to Boston. So it was, you know, like in my 20s, I was there, right? So I kind of grew up there. And then I was there for 11 years before I moved to the Bay Area. But I like the Bay Area more now. The weather is much better. The people, there's a lot of different kinds of people. While, you know, in Boston, everybody was more in academia and then goes to a larger company. There weren't that many people doing their own startups and stuff like that, so.
Yeah, that's true. I'm originally from the East Coast and I've been to Boston a ton. Boston's always so sports heavy as well. I've always noticed it's like such a big sports town too, which is like really interesting for me. But yeah, there's a vibe. There's definitely a vibe in Boston that's much different than the Bay Area. What's your favorite part about living in the Bay Area now?
I think it's the weather. The weather is always, you know, I don't know what it is in Boston right now, but it's nice and sunny and, you know, slightly chilly in the Bay Area right now.
Yeah, it's awesome. I love California. All right. So I know you have your son, obviously, but pre-motherhood, I am very curious. What did you do for fun?
It's interesting. It's like hard to remember pre-motherhood. That's like, I don't know, your brain like shuts it off just in general so that it's like you don't miss it. There's probably some hormones that go in your, you know, when you have a
coping strategy.
This is the life, you know. I would say I love to travel. I still love to travel whenever I get a chance. Even if it's a long weekend, like 3 days, I'll try to like go somewhere. At times I've gone like Japan even, you know. So travel is one. The other things that I picked up was like when I moved to the Bay Area, I was surfing. And
get out, really?
Yeah, so that's been... and also one of the things that you can like, it actually shuts your brain. Very few things actually shut your brain because you're just trying to survive. And then when the waves are hitting you, like that's all you're thinking about, you know, and you're not, but there's nothing else that goes in your mind at that time. So I think that was one. Also, I picked up hiking as well when we moved here. Yeah.
Yeah. California is one of my favorite places to hike, obviously. I'm sure. Have you been to Yosemite? You have to have been by now, right?
I have back in the day. I haven't been like recently.
Yeah, Yosemite is one of my favorite places on earth. It's like incredibly magical. And anywhere in the Sierra Nevada. So some of my master's was in geology, of all things. It took a very meandering path, but my master's research was in the South Lake Tahoe Basin. And so lived in a tent for 6 months and all that. But I hiked so much of the Sierra Nevada and you really spend a lot of time in the woods. It really, you know, creates a special place in your heart.
6 months in a tent.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
How did you do that?
It was easy. I mean, and it's funny because it was pre-cell phone for me. So I'm 47 now. And so it was actually the summer of it was 2001 because I was living in my tent actually when September 11th happened and I didn't know that it happened. So there was like this delayed response for me. When I came out of the woods, I was like, what's going on? What happened? And I remember the guy, actually, I went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium area, and I went to like Cannery Row, and I went into the soup shop, and there was like nobody around, and it was like super creepy. And I remember talking to this guy, and I was like, what's going on? Like, where are all the people? And he's like, have you been living under a rock? And I was like, actually, I have. Sorry. But yeah, you just get like, you know, you just use your camp stove and you hike. And I was in like research mode. I read a lot. I actually bathed in the streams and the rivers and stuff. It was like, yeah, it was pretty great. I mean, it's, yeah, it was one of the best times of my life. I had a lot of fun.
Did you have internet or no internet?
No internet. No, Google had just hit the scene, and I would go to an internet cafe maybe like once a month, but I only went to like an internet cafe if I was like needing to research something, and you had to pay by like every 30 minutes or something like that. So
I don't know if you like can do it now, you know, with the with the phones and everything. I don't know.
I know. It was a great time. I mean, I just remember I read a ton of books.
No.
I had a boyfriend with me at the time who was also a geologist. So he was like my field assistant. And yeah, I mean, I would read books, and then we would hike the whole next day, like doing research and stuff. And it was hilarious because I would just talk his ear off like the whole time. And it was helpful because I'd read my books, and then the next day I'd recite everything that I read to him the next day on the hikes, just to kind of keep the conversation going. You know, I read this book, Clan of the Cave Bears. I remember I got really into that whole series. And then that's when I actually started learning about food, our food system, because I got way into holistic health. And that's what led me to eventually become a holistic health coach. And that led into my dental coaching and all that stuff. But I, you know, drove cross country originally from New York and drove cross country to California. And I was really amazed by our food system. Like, I'd never had seen industrial agriculture, how anything was, where our food came from. And I was like, this is where our food comes from. And so I started, because I'm a learner, I started getting all these books, and I was trying to be vegan because I was like freaked out by everything, and that didn't work out. But I started reading all these books about food, and I was just like fascinated about how it all works. And that was kind of got the ball rolling to where I am today, essentially. But yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we should do a podcast on just that.
I could write several books, I think, of the adventures that I had. Yeah, it was, I know, and there was a guy, I mean, you'd be surprised, I mean, I guess you probably wouldn't be surprised, but there's a lot of people that, maybe today would be a little bit different, but, you know, there were some transients that were living in the woods back then, and some of them were really interesting characters, too, and I didn't know there were actually gypsies that were there in the woods as well, and they set up some killer camps, though. I have to say that. They had some really
only
nice...
Only done camping once. And that was... Yeah, only once. That was with friends. And I don't know if I... Yeah, so, like, I think, you know, you're at another level here. It's like, I don't know. I like my bed too much, you know?
Yeah. Now I definitely prefer a soft bed. I did do a backpacking trip a couple summers ago with my husband, and I was like hot and I was just kind of grumpy about it, but the situation wasn't ideal. But yeah, the Sierra Nevada is such an amazing place to camp because the weather there is just like perfect. But yeah, well, I'm happy you're in California. It's such a great place to explore, and I hope you get out there a little bit more. So what would you say, I suppose, to anyone that's like a skeptic of Overjet or products like Overjet, I suppose, in the dental community? What would you say in the simplest of terms to help ease their concerns?
I don't know what their concern is. You know, if they don't want to use it, it's okay. They don't have to. Like, that's true. Like, they can do dentistry without it. It's not like absolutely must, but it is for people who want to use and like who care about really exceptional patient care, who care about not wasting time on administrative tasks, who care about not you know, spending time on just documentation, etc. Overjet can be utilized across the board. So we help in diagnosis, treatment, communications, documentations, insurance checks, you know, and other pieces. So we help in a lot of pieces there. So depending on what their needs are, there might be value that they can get. But if they're happy with what they're doing, they can continue doing it.
Yeah, I like that. Well, Warda, what would you say to your 15-year-old self? If you were looking back, what was 15-year-old Warda feeling like? And if you could give her some tips of advice, what would it be?
I don't have like some like major advice or anything like that. I'm just trying to find what you like doing. I feel like it takes, or took me some time to really know what I really like doing and what I really should focus a lot of my time on. For me earlier, what you basically do what you're supposed to do, right? Go to high school, you go to college, you know, like it was like more of like, okay, like what's next? And you just do those steps rather than really doubling down on things that you really like to do or you think are exciting to work on.
Yeah, and you were reminding me, there's a marketing author, influencer, his name's Seth Godin, and he always talks about solving a problem. And I really like how you said that a few times, that that was, you know, behind the initiative too, is like, hey, I want to solve this problem. And that's what you kept following. And it sounds like that's what you continue to do, is show up and, you know, solve the next problem. And that's always where value gets created. And that's how, you know, we can make the biggest difference. Because if someone's coming from a place of like, how can I make the most money? Or how can I drive this or drive that? It can end up being sort of a shallower experience or a more shallow experience, and then you're busy trying to convince people that you create value, versus what you're doing is you're solving problems, and in turn, you know, that ultimately creates value for the people who need that problem solved.
Well, I would kind of say that, like, it being true to yourself, if like, yeah, if your mind works better with like thinking through like, hey, how can I make the most amount of money, and that's how you'll get to the outcome, like that's like, if that's true to you, just like doing that, because yeah, you'll be better off doing the things that are true to you rather than like trying to think like somebody else, or be like somebody else as well. Because just my mind doesn't think like that, or like I wouldn't be excited about that piece of it. So that's not what I lean on. But if you are, like if in the morning you can wake up and be like, whoa, like if I do this, I'll make a ton of money. And like, and if that gets you excited and like doing the things, in the end, what matters is the actions you take and what results you're showing. But like whatever is like inspiring you to do it, it could be whatever. And then like leaning into it and saying, okay, like that's the person I am. And maybe I need to care about that. And maybe I need to go into finance, you know, or, yeah. But, you know, so for me, it was like, it was about solving problems. That's why I went to engineering, right? Like that was an area that focused on. So like kind of the more you understand about yourself, and and being true to that, and like trying to understand what you like and really doubling down on it, in it, I think the better off you are.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, absolutely. That's huge. And I love that you've had the courage to find out who you are and continue to follow your passion. And we're all benefiting from you being yourself. So thank you for being you. You're such an inspiration to so many people, and what you're doing for the medical dental industry is just really, really cool. And you're pretty awesome. So you're a vibe, Warda. So thanks for being you. And the world needs you, and dentistry needs you for sure. So this has been super fun. And thank you for taking the time to chat with me today.
Awesome. No, thank you. Thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me.
You just listened to The Real Talk of Dental. If it hit, if it stung, if it made you feel just a little more human, good. That's the point. This isn't about fixing practices. It's about healing people. And if you're brave enough to show up real in this industry, you're my kind of leader. Subscribe, call in, send your wildest workplace confession. And most importantly, don't clean up for anyone. The mess, that's where the magic lives. We'll see you again on the next episode.